Good afternoon. I was briefly just going to tell you how we got this all started. Two, 3 years ago, I came on and started doing the operations for the church. Carolyn O'Brien, who had been doing our preservation work for us before that time, had told me that the St. Christopher's had some cracks and holes, and if you looked at it, you could tell. So I began bringing in different conservators to look at it, to give me estimates of what needed to be done. But during a cold spell in 2011, the lower half of this St. Christopher's literally disintegrated. And in the time when Ariana finally showed up, we watched pieces fall while we were looking at it. So we'd gone through the process of getting a grant from the Victorian Alliance, which John was very helpful in directing us that way. But once we realized we needed more than simply a repair, we started realizing we had to do a report on what's the state of it so we knew how best to go forward with the restoration. I went to the city and got a grant. Since they would not fund the actual work, but they would fund the report, they funded Ariana to come in and do work, say, as Joy had said, on all the pieces of glass. Because of its state, before Ariana even did that, I asked her to take it down and stabilize it, because we had a concern of it falling apart. We were very fortunate to find that most of the disintegrated crumbling pieces were stuck in between the glass, so we were able to restore quite a bit of it. So once we got Ariana on board, we spent quite a time restoring it, which we'll get into more detail. But once we put it into her hands, we really wound up with a plan that led us first to St. Christopher and now to the Dove Window. And other things look good, but now we know what to keep an eye on and how to move forward. So that's how we set this up to begin preserving these things that are so important to us. And Doug then began doing a lot more research on Porter itself. So I'll let him.
Yeah, I mean, as we started to restore the window, just more and more mysteries came up. And I'm going to share some of those mysteries with you today. And it's going to be a little bit of like a Jung Trill short talks, where he introduces something but doesn't give you the answer. That's what my talk is going to be like. So this is a picture of this sanctuary that was taken shortly after it was opened. And there's a lot of similarities to the way it is today. But I want to draw your attention to one key feature, and that is there's no cross. Isn't that strange for a Christian church to have no cross in the front? Well, it's actually not strange for a Swedenborgian church, because Swedenborg's theology doesn't really hinge on the crucifixion. What happens after that, that's important. So actually, it's very unusual to find a cross in a Swedenborgian church. But then you might ask, if we don't have crosses, why do we have a stained glass window of a saint? And it particularly is odd when you consider that Swedenborg didn't have a real high opinion of the concept of saints. In fact, he reports from one of his visits to heaven that through divine love and wisdom, these great men who we call saints are carefully protected from the corrupting influence of hearing all of these prayers that human beings are giving to them. So here we go. So here's the first mystery. Even though we don't have a cross, we have St. Christopher. Why is that?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
There's no altar either.
And that was before the altar was put in. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Yeah, I don't know exactly. It's an early picture. So, well, let's move on. So who, as we all know, the sort of guiding light for the construction of this building was Reverend Joseph Worcester, the first pastor, who strongly influenced the design of the building. But he wasn't the person who brought these stained glass windows in. Oh, but I should say, you know, this guy Worcester, in some way, he's an interesting character because theologically he was very conservative. So, you know, it isn't surprising that there's no cross in his church. He made fun of Darwin and his theory of evolution, and things like that. So and he never, I can't show you his photograph because he never allowed his photograph to be taken. There's actually one surreptitious photograph of him, but if you can find it. But generally, no. And so, you know, he was very quiet and even didn't allow names to be associated with the donations that were made to this church. But he wasn't responsible for the stained glass windows. This other guy, Bruce Porter, is the guy who did the windows. And you can start right off. Well, his photograph has been taken many, many times, in fact. And he is, this is him with his sister's husband and their children at the Cliff House. And you can see his brother-in-law is dressed in kind of the traditional dress of the day. But Porter is with his hat on and his cape over one shoulder. He is the typical bohemian artist that's, of the turn of the century. Rather flamboyant. In fact, he appears in the newspapers all the time. Here is one example of a newspaper sketch where they were having, they had a artist open house basically, and all the members of society descended on these artists' studios, and one of the studios was of course Bruce Porter's studio, and as they show up, he is there lecturing about how the vital importance of conversations with crows in the design, in the theory of interior design. And there he is in his flamboyant thing, and of course the newspapers capture this story. And you can't find an article in the paper, in the society page, that doesn't mention Bruce Porter. William Randolph Hearst came to consult with him about the design of the gardens at San Simeon. He was the cultural trendsetter. So how in the world did Porter and this more conservative gentleman, Reverend Worcester, almost two generations older than him, get connected? And why, in fact, after Worcester died, Porter confessed in a letter to Henry James that Worcester was one of his few really dear friends. So here we have two seemingly rather different people connected together in the design of this church. Now, certainly they did share some things in common. Specifically, I would say that they both shared a love of art. Clearly, Worcester was a mover and shaker in the bringing the concepts of the arts and crafts movements to the Bay Area, and Porter was certainly a mover and shaker in the art world, both arts and crafts and avant-garde. Another difference is that Porter was like virtually all forms of art, where Worcester gave several lectures condemning art for art's sake after Oscar Wilde visited San Francisco. But they certainly still had that in common, the love of art and its impact on the community. They also, Worcester was obviously Swedenborgian, and one of the clear differentiations between Swedenborgian theology and other Christianity is it's firmly based in a mystical experience that Swedenborg had. And Porter was definitely a mystic. He would love to talk about the mystical experiences he himself had. And I would have to say that those mystical experiences continue to this day. During the restoration of the window, and Ariana will talk about this in more detail, there's one piece of glass that was probably poorly annealed and so needed to be replaced. And Ariana and her staff spent a lot of time and effort trying to find a piece of glass that exactly matched in color, texture, every characteristic, the one that Porter had used. And when she found that, she invited both Greg and I over to her studio and wanted to get our agreement that, yes, this was the glass that should be used. And we both looked at it and spent some time thinking about it and said, yes, that's a very good match. You're not going to get any closer to that. So we said, go ahead, use that glass. Well, later on we learned that Ariana was woken up in the middle of the night by Bruce Porter's spirit, who told her that this glass was not acceptable. And so the next day she went in and told her staff to go out and search again. And they eventually found in the inventory of a retired chain stained glass artist the one piece of glass that would be perfectly matched. Well, at least that's how Bruce Porter would tell the story. Ariana might have a little bit different view of this. So now I'll turn it over to Ariana.
Oh, wow. Get back to my. There we go. go. So thank you all for coming to hear me talk and for your interest in this. I want to take a quick poll. How many people know the basics of putting together a stained glass window? Okay, so I won't go into that, and you'll probably figure it out if you don't know the main bits. The main components are glass, lead, putty, which you don't really see. It's kind of the unsung hero of stained glass. It's what actually keeps it together and weatherproofs it. And then we'll just go from here. So I was first contacted by Greg, as we were just told, to look at St. Christopher. And when I arrived here, it looked like this. And then he said, is that normal, the light coming through behind the leg? And I said, no, let's take a closer look. And like he also said, we agreed pretty much immediately that even before any work happened, that in order to stabilize what was existing there, that it needed to come to the studio to do the remaining part of the survey. So this is another reason why we decided, here are the pieces of glass stuck between them. Where's your pointer?
Oh, yeah.
Here. So the window is actually made of two total panels of glass. It's also plated, which means there's two pieces of glass on top of each other, but it's two panels. So luckily, the glass wasn't lost. It was just wedged between the two pieces. This was during the survey. You can see there's more glass here at the bottom. This is the back part of the window. We took these stops off in order to release the panels. You can see there's the top view, and this is the first time we opened it up completely. And I remember having this really animated conversation with you saying, do you know there's two panels? It's really exciting.
Well, that, I didn't know people know that this actually is a box, and it opens on hinges, and it's not just a set-in window.
Yeah, it's independent.
So that's what it's in, that actual window.
Yes, yeah, pretty unusual. So when we took out the first piece, we saw this just tiny little shards of blue glass, which I note now because it comes up again with the dove window. Also, this is the original frame. You can see that there was splitting going through, and it was splitting on sides, so it was pushing on the two panels of glass and probably exacerbating the problem of cracks. So what we decided to do was keep all the original hardware and replicate the frame. The other thing that we noted that was really unusual is that after the two panels had been built, Porter decided, for some reason, maybe it was too bright, or he had another idea, to paint parts of the glass. All of the painting on the glass is cold painting. In general, when you paint for stained glass, you fire it in a kiln and it adheres really well to the glass. In this case, it's cold, so it's really, really fragile. The way we deduce this is that you can see these streak marks going across to the border glass, and it's actually going over the lead as well. In addition, the top layers of glass, a part of the dismantling process. This is how it arrived in the studio. The glass was being released from the lead, probably because these pieces of glass were taken out to be repainted. Here's more of this unusual, this part was colored kind of a purple color going on the top of the lead. And this is the face of St. Christopher. It was also unusual that when you look at it here, it's actually on the panel that's on the outside or the exterior. So it's very muted, but this is what it looks like on the light table. And you could see the detail better on the light table than if you held it up to the light. This is more traditional of what you see for plating, and this is what I thought the window was before we took it into the studio. So there's one panel, and this is called plating, and then separate layers of glass are leaded on top. So from outside, from the courtyard, you can see these pieces on the back. So we did rubbings. I didn't put photos of those in here because I have detailed rubbings of the dove window. But what that is before we do any work, we put a piece of paper over the lead and rub across it with a crayon to give us all the detail. Then we mark the lead, any anomalies, and it also gives us a blueprint on which we have to rebuild the windows. So this is taking off the plating, and you can see to create depth, there's one piece on top and there's three underneath. And then we slowly use dental tools to release the top layer because we did one rubbing with all the plating and then we had to do a separate one once that top plating was removed. We also took readings with calipers on the exact width of the lead so we could replicate that as well. So here's the culprit. And I think for my studio, this is what we'll remember the most about the conservation of both of these windows in a good way. We became very intimate with this piece of glass and also sheet of glass, which I'll allude to later. This was one piece of glass, and you can see there's multiple cracks going on and tiny little holes as well. Behind here is blue tape just to keep everything together. This is why the pieces were actively falling out. This piece of glass, and there were other ones, we think maybe the same large sheet of glass was used both for St. Christopher and for the dove window. When the sheet of glass was made originally, it wasn't annealed correctly, which means that glass is made sort of like, imagine treacle or taffy, and then as it cools down, you have to cool it down at a proper rate, and if you go too fast, this will happen, but it may not happen immediately. So you let a window, it looks great, 30, 40 years happen, and all of a sudden it just catastrophically falls apart. So not knowing this glass as well as we do now, I thought, well, we're a conservation company. We want to save every single piece of glass. Let's try to clean the surface of the glass before we take the panel apart. We'll consolidate it, put glue on top, and see if we can just sort of sandwich it together within that glue, and then we can rebuild it. So this was that process. These are all the pieces that were affected. So we taped everything after putting the glue over the surface, and then we dismantled it carefully. These are all the pieces of glass. This one was the problem child, so it got thrown in the corner. But these other pieces were a little bit more stable. This window is, it's not an active window, meaning that both the interior and exterior are in the same environment. It's more of a piece of art hung in front of a window as opposed to this window, which is within the frame. So we thought we could conserve more of these pieces, and we can also access it if anything happens in the future. So this is the process of consolidating it. You have to put it on wax paper, put a border around the side, and then add an epoxy to the top of the cracks, and that works with capillary action to put everything together. Another thing we did was, if there were large pieces of glass where there were little chips on the bottom, that we just, every time you try to glue it together, another piece would come apart. We wanted to save that large piece of glass. You can see it's the one on the right. So here's the rubbing that we did of St. Christopher. And what I'm doing is tracing around the border where the glass needs to be, and the area of loss I just filled with colored epoxy. So we're able to keep the majority of the glass while adding those small pieces, as opposed to saying, well, there's a little gap that's missing, let's get a whole new piece of glass. And here is the process of building the, this is the top piece, the front. So each piece of glass, after it was cleaned and glued back together, is set together And then there's lead that's placed on either side, and you just sort of patchwork build it up from that. There's sometimes people have a misconception that you just put all the pieces of glass together and you pour molten lead around it. That's not the case. That would go much faster. And here is, this is the Porter Ghost piece that we use. Again, this is the original. This is the original. This used to be one large piece. But we felt that there was enough of it that was relatively stable that we keep that. And then because this is water, we use smaller lead to denote that it wasn't the same as everything else, and add this in. And I feel that even though it's a little bit lighter, it still reads like it's part of the window. Here's the new frame, which is this frame, before we stained it. This is a test fitting. And another thing that we did, and also had a justification for using this frame, was that we felt that the original frame was, because it was moving so much, it was putting added pressure on those two panels. So we built it out a little, the space for the panels is about 1/32 larger, so it just gives those two pieces a little bit more space to breathe while still being secure. And we also, this is installing it, and the two pieces offset a little bit. The two pieces were really tightly installed together. So on the outside, when you open it up, there's a little bit more steppage on the wooden stops, which just gives those two panels a little bit more independent space. And I thought this would be really interesting because you never see this. These are the two panels separately. So this is the top panel, the one that's to the inside. And this is the painted panel.
Can you flip back and forth?
So they knew, that takes some visual.
Imagination. And you can see, like, if you look in the drapery here, this is what we were looking at before, when you take off, this is one piece covering all these other ones here. And I really like this little rogue piece in the corner. It's the only one that's different, that has a different part, different palette than the rest of it. But you can almost, I mean, you don't see it together. So it demonstrates that Porter was really thinking as creating depth and movement. And I mean, I know you have the window right here. I put this together for someone who may not see, but just the angles of this, it just seems like there's so much movement in the glass. It's definitely not a static piece, and it's really gorgeous. I could talk about this window all day. I'm going to try to move on to the next one, which I'm sure in everyone's mind is more recent and perhaps more curious. So we're going to go back in time a little bit. I also climbed up on the roof when Greg and I first met and looked at the dove window and thought, well, wow, this is kind of interesting as protection. You have this, sorry, it's a little off kilter, but you have this gorgeous brickwork, this gorgeous window, and then chicken wire, rusting chicken wire. And I thought, oh wow, that's kind of interesting. There's some weird cracks in that blue glass, but didn't really think that much about it. When we were contacted to move forward on the Dove, having just finished St. Christopher, it wasn't, oh wow, there's cracks in that glass. It's like, oh no, it's that blue glass. So here's more of a wire, and there's damage in the frame as well. On the inside, you may recall that there were these really big steel support bars with these little twists. So it was a good idea to put in steel reinforcement, and it's in other parts in the building. But in this case, it wasn't really holding the window together, and a lot of these had detached from the window. And this is, sorry, this is a horror, you're not your photo, a horrible photo from before. This was a quick one. And you can see that there's no, you can't see the red border at all. So we had to detach it from the support bars. They weren't connected. And knowing about the blue glass now, we just taped everything on both sides. It's better to overtape and not have problems than start to take a window out and halfway through say, tape it now, it's gonna fall apart. So we always like to be prepared. And here's what the steel looked like with the window removed. This was also concerning. It was anchored in on the sides from inside, but from outside, especially on the bottom, there were these big gaps where if there was any water movement getting to this point, it would just sit in there and start to corrode the wood, which is actually what happened. So as you also know, usually what we do when we take out a window, it's a cost-saving measure. We just put in a piece of board. But working with Doug, we did a Lexan copy of the window and installed that with our proposed protective glazing. That's this single sheet of clear glass, which you can see on the outside of the building now. And we just tapped it in for added protection while we conserved the window. This is the window as we first got it in the studio. You can see how dirty it was. And then this is the window after we did a first pass of vacuum to prepare the rubbings. We had to do three rubbings of this window because there was also plating on these pieces. And also we needed to look at the front and the back. And this is what we do for every project that we do, at least one rubbing before we take a window apart. So you can see here, this isn't very detailed because we were just calling out the plating, which is on the interior side of the building. Once we remove the plating, this is what the actual window looked like. So there's more notation as to where the bars were anchored. And then here's the damaged glass. And you can also see sort of these little lines in here. That's every single crack we noticed. And then we also did a flip side of the back. And these are all the blue glass pieces that were starting to come apart. Again, we removed the plating. This is what it looked like halfway with the plating removed. And then we started to clean the pieces. So these are some of the plated pieces at the bottom of the window. So a lot of discussion happened back and forth with the church as to what we should do with the blue glass. Because it's part of the building, because we knew it was going to continue to crack, because we'd had the experience with St. Christopher, we made a joint decision that we tried to replace that blue glass with something similar in texture, tone, movement, and orientation of how the glass was. And we worked with Ted Ellison as well because he has an amazing stock of glass. He's a stained glass artist in Oakland, and he's also very interested in porter, so we thought he was a perfect match for this project. So you can see all these pieces here with the blue tape underneath, again, are calling out the replacement pieces. Another thing that we discussed was the fact that as you build the window, you're going piece by piece, and we think what happened is that blue glass maybe cracked once, and instead of replacing that, my only thought can be that Porter thought this glass is amazing, I don't want to use anything else, this is for this space. So instead of replacing that glass, he didn't have enough, he just put a lead line in there. So we worked with Doug as well, thinking, you know, is this a line that we think Porter actually wanted to use to delineate his design, or is it a salvage one? Mm-hmm. So the pieces are slightly larger, and I'll show you a photo at the end where we can compare and contrast. Here's a detail. You can see that there's a lot of movement in this glass. One of the things we had to choose with the replacement glass was that all the ripples were going in the same direction, and we only had a finite amount of glass. So in some cases, we found glass that was a perfect color, but the ripples were going this way, so couldn't use it. I also would like to note Armelle LaRue, who is my forewoman, also a glass artist in her own right. She was a key player in selecting the glass, and she went through every single piece, figuring out which ones went where and which ones worked with the movement of the pattern, and also color-wise. Here's the main panel completely built, and then we're starting to put on the plating here as a second level, and this is the lead, a profile of it. So you see this little, it kind of looks like a Roman eye, and that's how what holds the glass in. And in some cases, it made more sense to build the plated section separate from the rest of the window, and then tack solder it and put that on top of the main window, as opposed to try to build it on a window that we knew had fragile glass in it. So here's the main window built. And this is one of my other employees, Kirk. He's cleaning all the lead joints after they've been soldered, and he's finger putting it. And here's Armelle working on the second rubbing of the plating pieces. So she built this whole section and then carefully moved it over to its corresponding area. It's this top section. So that's why this looks more blue, and this other part is all green. And this is one of my few nods to the other hat that I wear as an artist. I just love the fact this is after we finish the panel and we packaged it all up and we're ready to bring it over to the church. This just shows all the action that we used building the window. So you can see all the little lead marks and the fact that it's been moved around a lot, and it's we were also somewhat bereft that the window had finally left the studio and was coming back here. So this is part of the final installation. The wooden frame that I called out before had to be removed. So this is the bottom section that had rotted away. And one reason that it had rotted away was that it was one unit. So if you think a tree has grains that go around, if you take it out of one, eventually they're all the grains will face up and the water will infiltrate in and spread apart, kind of like a sponge. So Daniel, one of my other employees who's amazing with wood, keyed a lot of pieces of wood together and then carved them out. So the top layer, even though it's curving, will always have a flat section. I have another photo of that. But here is also what was revealed as to where those large steel support bars went. So this is a huge hole at the bottom of the window, which is not good. So we patched that up as well. Here's Daniel working. He built two just in case one didn't fit or we needed to add more. He's sanding it down to fit into place. Here's the hole before. And here, before we stained it, is the fill. And then we were able to put thinner pieces of steel on end on the border where the original steel had gone. And as you know, now you can see the red border. So here, I don't have to go back and forth this way because you have the actual window. But the things I'd like to note are these extra repair leads are now gone. So it reads as a clear window. And one of the few design aesthetics that we felt we could improve upon. Basically, conservators try to respect everything that the original artist did and don't try to change anything, even if we think it could be done better. But one of the discussions we had back and forth was this line here, the branch, was covered up and was all black. I don't know if you can see from down here. On this photo, you can see really well. And here, it's green. It's not because it was dirty before, it's because the lead completely encompassed tiny pieces of original green glass. Mm-hmm. And we thought it was probably because whoever actually glazed the window didn't have the right type of lead or didn't have the proper detail to reveal that glass without that area falling apart. So we decided, since we discovered the glass in there, it wasn't just a lead fill, that we would take the liberty to reveal that glass again. So we did it there. And then obviously the border, which you can't, just red is black because those steel support bars were in front, has now been revealed. So I think I've gone over my time, but hopefully it was interesting and I'm ready to answer questions. So should I just stay up here? Yes?
Do you have estimates of how many person hours went into each piece?
I should. I have them in my computer and my office manager could tell me. I think one of the reasons why I don't have that offhand, or if I don't say, you know, every piece had this many pieces, or every window had this many pieces, is that, you know, it for me, and I think everyone who works at Zilani, it takes as long as it takes. So for us, we don't gauge it that way. We just think about the project and the process. But if you'd like to know, I can look it up and I can email Dana. You. Yeah.
I noticed that in the, I know that the color is off on the bird bath, but in the bird bath water, there's no color in the before, and there's quite a few different colors in the bird bath water.
Those are all original. I think it was just, as you know, when the light changes, the window reads differently. We didn't replace anything that was single layer. It was just the plating. Yes?
Two questions.
Yes.
One is, do you think the original source of the glass was North American or local, or hard to tell?
I don't know. I mean, a lot of the windows that we've worked on, the source glass comes from the East Coast. Tiffany, I know, used Kokomo, Indiana glass. But we don't know. There aren't any records of it.
What we do know is that in a newspaper article, Porter complained about the fact that he had to go to the East Coast to get glass and compared it to trying to paint a picture in San Francisco when your palette was in New York.
So that might be another more supporting evidence as to, even though this glass wasn't perfect mechanically, artistically, it's the glass he wanted to use and kept on using it.
And how do you manage lead exposure for yourself and your staff?
When it's new, it's not that bad. We all wear blue gloves. I make everyone test their lead levels every year. I test my lead level, and I know every time I go to see a doctor and I tell them what I do, they get really stressed out, and then I get my levels back and they're less than what someone who lives in a Victorian home who doesn't clean the paint. When we're dealing with old lead, there is lead oxide and the powder goes everywhere, so we wear respirators, but when we dismantle, which is when most of it goes up, we dismantle underwater if there's stable paint, so then it's just captured within the water. Good question, though. Yes?
I had an experience years ago talking to Mrs. May back in Berkeley about this window. I asked her, why was there a St. Christopher here? She said, probably was St. Christopher. It was a metaphor that the pastor was the chaplain of the boys' orphanage.
Right.
The ships came in and people brought typhus back. So the kids were put in orphanages. And two men were the rescuers, Bruce Porter with his money and Worcester as chaplain. And she thought in the family that it was a symbol of that.
Right. I love
it's
that story.
It's a great symbol.
Right.
But that's the way they thought in those days.
Right. Well, I love that that is tied to the window.
I love seeing that when redone.
Oh, thank you. I loved redoing it.
I do.
Yes?
You know, there's no longer those reparative pieces of lead.
Yes.
Is there a whole new pieces of glass in those panels now? Or?
Yes. Yeah, so those are the pieces that we were debating. Do we save the original, or do we go with something else?
You had a dream of that.
Oh no, that was this one.
Was
yeah, dream. Yeah. And I didn't have a dream. But I did wake up. I didn't see Porter, but I had this feeling that I think we can find something that's a little bit better. So maybe that's just my modern interpretation of Porter.
And which piece was that?
It was the one on the side by the cloak and his leg. Because it was encapsulated by the original, I wanted to find something that was a really good piece and not taking away from it. One of the things we try to do in conservation, if we do have to replace, is not call out our work. We really want to be in the back and support the original artistic piece and not put our own into... Yeah, I really feel like we're ushering these pieces into a new generation. So, you know, if we wanted to be... We all do our own new art on the side, but it's not our place to put our stamp on it. We're just making sure it's getting better for the next generation. Yes?
Coal paintings, did we refresh any paintings also with coal paintings?
So in that case, we just consolidated it, which meant that we put a clear layer on top. So we kept everything, but to preserve it, but we didn't add anything else. If there were areas of loss, there weren't significant areas of loss. You can still read what the intent was. So again, I didn't want to add my interpretation of like, I think there might be another brushstroke here. So I just left what was there. But we didn't, when we re-leaded it, we didn't repaint the border lead around it to match, but we did note it. So one of the things that I'm really passionate about is conservation and documentation. So when I leave, you still have this document as to what we did and what it looked like before. Mm-hmm. So we don't just go and fix it, and then you have no idea what we did, and you have no idea what you had before. Mm-hmm. So that's why pictures and written explanations of what we did are so important.
Change control.
Say what?
Change control.
Yeah, exactly. You had another question.
Well, you sort of anticipated it. Are there steps that this institution needs to take so that the next conservator 75 years from now knows
what
you did, materials will be changed, and new materials available to kind of give guidance down the road?
Right. Well, you've got the rubbings. We take photos of them, but you get the original rubbings. And I know even in my relatively short existence, you know, floppy disks, who has a computer that'll play that. So I think something that's actually tactile, that's the right size, is something that you have. And then you also have the survey and a list of all the materials. And you also have all the original glass. So if someone in the future finds some crazy zapper thingy that can consolidate all the glass, you can take this out and put back what you had originally. So I think the main thing is just to save everything you have and to be quite open, have an open relationship so we don't go off into our little cave and do what we do and say, hey, presto, here you go. You're as knowledgeable as we are after this project. You and then you. Yes?
So, kind of expanding on that question, do you have a record of all the debates you had? So in 75 years, somebody is thinking, oh, well, originally this had bigger steel bars, and they took off the steel bars, and we're going to put them back on. Do you have a record of that? Those decisions?
Yeah, so there's the emails going back and forth. There's also a report that you'll be getting too, and then, you know, we also have copious amounts of footage of us debating back and forth with Ian. So I think that's, you know, unless we can't play your film in 75, 100 years, we'll have that as well. So. Yes?
Bruce Porter was also a poet. And I noticed the iris. One of his poems says, with the bloom of the iris, I give you the key of life, whatever that means.
Right. I didn't get the key of life by working here. I'm sorry. Yeah.
But
it wasn't tucked into the window.
But it may connect.
Right. Yes?
For earthquakes, is it better to have the panels floating in the frame or have them firm in the frame? And how do you sort of deal with that question?
Right. Well, lead lasts about 100 years, so you've taken care of that problem. In general, you don't want a window really tight in a frame. You also don't want it loose so it can rattle around. So there's a little bit of tolerance about around the frame, but it's sealed in, so that's how you deal with it. And you also have to take into consideration the design of the window, the pieces of the glass. So for something like this, you actually want it to move a little bit more than something that is new glass, but we do think about it.
Does the putty act like a shock absorber in that case?
A little, well, it depends. You know, when it's new, it's a little bit more malleable. When it becomes really, over time, it becomes more brittle. So maybe that comes out and then the lid moves around. So yeah, it's constantly moving that way. Yes?
I guess over your time as a conservationist, has having to think about all these people not knowing whether something was intentional or a compromise under certain circumstances, has that at all influenced how you ask other people in your studio to keep records of your own decisions and compromise you have to make either as a conservator or in your own artistry in case someone has to ever work on your
right career? Right. One of the reasons that I established my company is that I found that in some of the other places that I had worked, conservation note-taking wasn't as prevalent as I would have thought it should be. I think it's because I came from a museum background and that in a museum you have the time and the space to note everything. So that's what we do when we're working on anything. When I established the company from day one, we started taking notes on everything. And sometimes you take notes and say, I did this, and then you come back 2 or 3 weeks later and say, that didn't work, it didn't work because. And I think that's as valuable and as valid as doing a technique and it works the first time out. Because people, like you said, don't have to repeat that in the future. I think I think conservation in general is moving that way. I think in the past, especially restorers were very proud about their work, and if they did something that didn't work out well the first time, they'd kind of sweep it under the table. And I think it's a disservice to the art, and we should have enough of a humble ego that it's, we didn't do anything wrong, we just tried something and it didn't work, and we moved forward and fixed it. And I think that's quite important. So I sometimes do have to circle back and say, okay, remember, let's note everything again. But throughout the whole process, that's something that's really important. And especially when we're doing larger projects, when a window is comprised of, you know, 18, 20 pieces, it's really important to take notes on everything. Anything else?
This is a beloved space. It's a sacred space. We are the stewards of this space. And Ariana pointed out as we were getting ready to set up that she is in more churches probably than most people, or longer than most people. And that there is something different between a church, a sacred space, and a historic building for secular use. That is surely true in this space. And once again, we thank you as a congregation for investing in the sacred art in this space with its history, as we now can add to this that perhaps St. Christopher is here not as a saint, but as a image that recalls the care for orphans that was so dear to Bruce Porter and to Reverend Worcester. And I will remind you that it is stewardship season, and that on our little gift things, the image of the dove window, there's the spiritual life, the ongoing operations, and the sanctuary fund where the congregation can save for the next time we have to do something. Hopefully it'll be 100 years till we have to redo the work on the windows, but there are many other things that will take our attention. So thank you very much for your attention, and may I encourage you to come to additional things like the lecture series that celebrates 10 years of Landmark. Thank you. Very much.